morning. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Please silence all cell phones. The time is 9 a.m. March 1st, 2023. Today we're joined by Chair Stedman, Senator Wilson, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, myself, Senator Bishop. There's one item on the day's agenda, presentation by the Alaska Municipal League, Niels Andreessen, Alaska's local governments. Please come forward. Mr. Andreessen, put yourself on the record and start your presentation. And I'll manage the table and look at questions at the end of each slide.
Great, thank you. For the record, Niels Andreessen, I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. And thank you for the time with you this morning to talk a little bit about Alaska's local governments. Maybe I'll start. We were asked to talk about post-COVID, how are communities faring? And I'm struck by a conversation I had with a principal yesterday, a young woman with a family who, after my presentation that talked broadly about the state's fiscal and other challenges, came up and asked me, what do I do? I don't have housing. I don't have childcare. I have a job that I love, a state that I want to work in, but I have very few options for advancing within this space. And she wasn't looking to the state to solve something. She wasn't looking to AML or to local governments to solve something. She said, what can I do personally to make a difference in this space? And I think that's really where most communities are at, is trying to figure out how do we meet the needs of our residents right now in a way that positively contributes to their future? And I don't want to be in a position where I'm responding to that young woman and saying, go elsewhere where there's housing and childcare and opportunity. And I think that's the work in front of us. And the slides today will probably talk about how do we work together to make sure that her future is realizable.
I'd like to just interject here for a second. I would like to recognize that Senator Hoffman and Senator Olson are excused and they're away on other state business. And Senator Giesel has been in the room for some time. Please continue.
Thank you. I've only been in this position for 5 years. It feels like a lot longer than that. The last 5 years have been eventful, at the very least. So my first year in this position in 2018 was remarkable in that the Supreme Court considered the Wayfair case and extinguished physical presence necessary for collection of sales tax and open up the opportunity for remote sales tax. So back in 2018, AML worked with others to establish the Alaska Remote Seller Sales Tax Commission, or ARSSTC, and I'll talk more about that later. In 2019, local governments were looking at an FY19 budget proposal by the governor that cost shifted almost $1 billion back to communities, and I think that was a hallmark for all of us to be really cognizant of where the state's fiscal issues, what impacts they had. In 2020, we had COVID and a federal government that responded with the CARES Act, and a governor and legislature who distributed $586 million to local governments to make their communities whole, a very eventful and meaningful contribution into those communities that they're still reporting on today and even distributing or making sure that that they're complying with the federal guidelines around those funds. 2021 saw the American Rescue Plan Act, ARPA, $1 billion out to local governments around the state. And that's, I think, between local and tribal, huge amounts of funds available to local governments to continue to respond to the effects, less of the public health emergency and more on the economic crisis. And we've been supporting their efforts and complying with and reporting to the U.S. Treasury. Finally, this last year saw the passage of IIJA, the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act, or BIL, the bipartisan infrastructure law, and AML and partners have stood up the ability to provide technical assistance to communities. So it's been a busy 5 years, but when I think about post-COVID, where communities are at, we've gone through, to some extent, economic recovery, and with the passage of the infrastructure law, much more focused now on addressing the infrastructure deficit, which 2 years ago AML pegged at about $30 billion just for local governments. And we've got work to do these next 4 years left of the five-year BIL to continue to try to meet that challenge. I mentioned the Alaska Remote Seller Sales Tax Commission, ARSSTC. This is a slide that shows the growth of the sales tax collected over at least the last 3 years, recognizing that it began just a little the year prior with very minimal collections that first year. But this has been a substantial improvement for the condition of those communities that are participating in the program. 46 local governments participate in the ARSSTC out of 106 who have sales taxes. That doesn't, in terms of who this impacts, it doesn't include some of your larger municipalities like Anchorage or Fairbanks or the Mat-Su Borough, but it does affect very many others. We're collecting, AML provides the services to the ARSSTC to collect those sales taxes on their behalf. And you know, just this last month, we saw more than $2 million come in. And would expect for FY or for 2023, these are calendar years, more than $20 million to come in to communities. And it sounds like a lot, but it's worth keeping in mind that $20 million is just a portion of the more than $240 million that's collected each year for sales tax, for all sales tax revenue. Which is only a small piece of the over $2.5 billion in total revenue that local governments collect through a variety of taxes and other revenue streams. So it's been important. It was especially important during the public health emergency when sales tax generally declined in some communities. It's had at least a replacement value during that period. It also varies. I think the other thing to know is that for some communities, larger communities who have more of an economy and more choices, that sales tax collection might only be 5% increase to what they had experienced in the past. For other very small communities, it could be as much as 20% of an increase and with very few other opportunities for revenue. So it's been important for many of our communities. It's something that we'll continue to see grow. There's still 60 communities that we'd love to see signed up as part of this program who choose often to not participate because they don't want to see that additional cost to residents. But this is only the lawful collection of their current sales tax. And I think what's been important to those who are participating is leveling the playing field for businesses in their community. We'll expect to continue to see improvement on this, including to the almost 3,000 sellers who participate in the program and are remitting those lawfully collected taxes.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What is this? You haven't told us what this is yet. How it works.
Through the chair. So this is the remote sales tax collection that local governments are allowed to do after the passage of the Wayfair case that was before the Supreme Court. So this is the collections each month and growth month on month for the 46 communities that participate in that program.
Follow up. So is this like internet sales when they buy something on the internet, or is this when they go down to the local store and they buy something and then they send the sales tax to you guys and you disperse it, or
yeah.
Need to
Senator,
tell us what this thing is.
Yeah, Senator Stedman, through the chair. This is online, mostly, but it could be any sale into a community that's not physically present in the community. So any seller outside the community would be collecting the community's tax. There are three key features of the Wayfair case that required the ability, or that allowed for the ability for that collection by jurisdictions around the nation. It had to be streamlined, single level, statewide. And Alaska is unique in the nation in not having a state that collects sales tax, but allows local governments to do so. So what communities did is come together and they have a single level system. They have a single platform, a portal for sellers to remit those taxes into. We manage that and we remit those taxes back out to the participating jurisdictions. It's streamlined in that they all operate off of a single uniform code. So they maintain their current codes, but they adopt a uniform code as it applies to remote sales tax. They keep their rates, they keep their exemptions, and everything is managed through an online system that we manage.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. has the ring fencing situation gotten better over time? For example, the cities of Palmer and Wasilla, you can live within the city limits, or you can still have a Palmer address outside the city limits, which you're not taxed, same as Wasilla, you can be outside. And that's been was a little hard in the first the start of this. And some folks that should have been being taxed were being taxed. And...
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilson. To some extent, the AML and the ARSSTC provide all sellers with GIS-coded jurisdictional boundaries that we encourage them to use. When they use that, there's appropriate ring fencing. For sellers who use their own system, often they're still relying on zip codes instead of a GIS-bounded system, so that ends up problematic. But I think we have seen most of those issues work through for most communities. And we've developed processes for refunding where inappropriate taxation has occurred.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further questions, please continue.
The other, I mentioned ARPA and IJA or BIL, the federal funding that has come into Alaska over the last few years and will continue these next few. AML and the partners on the screen have put together basically an Alaska Infrastructure Coordinating Committee that hosts akfederalfunding.org. And on that site, which is a clearinghouse for all Alaskans, nonprofits, businesses, tribal governments, local governments can find current grant opportunities that we think will be important for Alaska communities, any compliance and reporting needs that they have, especially still for ARPA, and then guidance on and resources for infrastructure funding. There's a tracking mechanism for funds that were identified broadly for Alaska, but not for distributed funds that have come into the state upon award. Ultimately, what we and working with partners want to make sure we do is to maximize the benefit to Alaska communities from these federal investments. We meet every other week to talk through barriers, challenges, opportunities, ways to work together, and how to get information out to potential and eligible recipients of these funds.
How do you think your density is getting out there with the communities as far as knowing what you do here with this one-stop shop?
Senator Bishop, we've got work to do. This was originally designed to respond to ARPA, and we had really good, I think, density. Everybody was using that as a one-stop shop to sort through how to navigate ARPA. And we're still going through ARPA compliance with U.S. Treasury. We've got compliance annual reports that are due in April. That'll mean that we're reaching out to all communities to make sure reports are in. The two infrastructure symposiums that we helped co-host last year, I think, helped to improve that density. I think almost 2,000 people signed up or registered through this site to receive email updates that go out every week, at the very least, it seems like. That's the work that we were able to do this first year. I think the second year out of 5 years, the real need will be for us to be more intentional in reaching especially rural communities and more disadvantaged communities, folks who haven't been able to have the resources to participate effectively in the program. We want to better meet their needs. So there's work to do.
Thank you. Please continue.
Finally, just in terms of the state's fiscal situation, I think, you know, last year really demonstrated to us what a baseline felt like. And I want to thank this committee and the legislature and everyone involved in the full funding of community assistance, including recapitalization and paying back that community assistance. The same for school bond debt reimbursement, including harbor debt reimbursement. That made communities whole from after 3 years of underfunding or lack of funding for a lot of those programs. So I think that gave us a real clear indication of, you know, what a good partnership between state and local governments look like. And I borrowed this chart from legislative finance that shows, you know, ups and downs each year. And I think local governments live in that space of a little bit dependent on agency operations and funding, making sure that agencies have what they need to conduct their business and in support of local governments, a lot of statewide items, and then a capital budget. And it's that space that we really pay attention to. And last year was really a corrective for many years of underfunding in that space. So when we think about moving forward in terms of the state's fiscal situation and budget, you know, we would continue to hope for improvements in that area and to hold the line on making sure those things are funded.
Thank you. Please continue.
When I think about post-COVID and where communities are at, there are definitely some cross-cutting impacts that we're paying attention to. Inflation, for as much as I don't agree that the infrastructure funding is a windfall, I think, again, we're just addressing long-term infrastructure deficit. It is true that inflation is cutting into our ability to make the most of that investment. And I get weekly updates from members who say the project that we, you know, were quoted last year for one amount has risen now by 20-50 percent or more. So we're very definitely paying attention to the impact of inflation on our ability to make those infrastructure investments. Supply chain, which is tied to that to some extent, impacts project deployment at the same time, especially for public transport, water and wastewater, parks, bridges, any of the basic infrastructure investments that communities are wanting to make. Supply chain issues are compounding the effect of inflation. And then I know you're familiar around this table with Alaska's population and demographics and how that's impacting you know, public education and workforce. But I think communities are experiencing this firsthand, the impact of more out-migration than in-migration, or at least not keeping pace. And that certainly is being felt in communities around the state.
All right. And the low birth rate doesn't go unnoticed either.
Yep. Those cross-cutting kind of challenges that we're seeing spill out in, you know, the economic development that Alaska communities want to facilitate. And when it comes to you know, economic development, we know how important housing and childcare is to making sure that we can retain a workforce and that we can see business development in the coming years. AML does host a housing task force, and it's been looking at a variety of first data collection, but wanting to really understand the scale of the challenge and how it impacts different communities differently. and has draft recommendations out for what local, state, and federal actions could be. And I'll touch on those in a later slide. Ultimately, we know that this is a barrier to economic development, and we want to make sure that we're at the forefront of helping to address that. The same is true for childcare, and I appreciate the work that the Alaska Chamber and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has done on evaluating the impact of childcare, the childcare desert on Alaska, and something like $175 million loss to our GDP or our economy because of the lack of affordable childcare. And it's impacting families and the choices they make about going to work, staying in community, sending kids to school, and or considering leaving. So these end up two very significant priorities for ANL members.
Senator Wilson? Did you have a Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dealing with AML and the statewide, when you look at the codes, fees, and other processes of the municipalities, is there quite a discrepancy? And also, have you found a lot of added layers, especially for codes versus what the federal requirements are?
Senator Stedman, through the chair. We're actually building a database of what that looks like between communities, and trying to track who's utilizing the powers they have, how are they utilizing it for zoning and various codes. We're early in that process, but what we want to have is a comprehensive a data set to be able to work, you know, with you and others to work to address. On the code issue, we haven't gotten to that level of detail. It's also, I think we're just trying to figure out right now kind of what that universe in which communities are actually have codes in place that are having some impact. I do know there is pretty incredible variety between communities, and we're also participating in, we've talked with AHFC about developing not a statewide code, but, you know, basically a suite of options or best practices for code development that could be shared with municipalities. We really want to spend more time in sharing between communities so that they can streamline what they're doing and if there are solutions in their work to adopt them.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Yes, sorry.
Thank you. Please continue.
In terms of the housing task force, we did poll members on the experiences that they're having. And this is why we know it's so important to our members. When it comes to whether there are enough rentals, whether there's enough for sale, whether things are affordable, the majority of respondents, the overwhelming majority of respondents strongly agreed with those as priorities and as challenges. We're looking at, you know, whether current statute gives local governments all the tools they need to address land use, subdivision access, development, and broader economic development. And it's certainly true that there are differences between home rule governments and first class and then second class cities and boroughs, and we want to be mindful of and respect the powers they currently have, but make sure there aren't barriers or burdens within the statute that keep them from acting in response. There's a short list of topics that communities are considering around the state listed here, anything from blighted properties to accessory apartments, looking at density and rezoning for that. Looking at short-term rentals and potential restrictions, or at least some level of code development that better guides the development of short-term access. But these are all things that we're looking at right now. We've got a team of local government municipal officials who are exploring this further.
Senator Stedman, then Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the concerns that have been brought forth to me, both by university lands and then the mental health, dealing with subdivisions is the added requirements at the local level on subdivisions driving the costs up so high, then they don't move forward with their subdivisions. And then the communities get strangled off on land, and it's kind of self-induced in a certain degree. So I'd recommend you try to take a look at that, because we've had several meetings on this subject trying to crack the housing nut. The other thing that has been brought to light is the transition to short-term rentals, longer-term rentals, forcing the displacement of a lot of young Alaskans, or people that when you have a job opening and you want to hire someone to bring them in the community, there's no place for them to live, and they won't take the job. So that is a challenge, and it would be nice when you do your data set to you know, take a look at some of the communities that are more problematic and give us an idea. I think Sitka would be probably one of the top ones on the list for that. And again, that gets into the local zoning and platting issues at the local level, so that gets kind of dicey. But it is at such a level that it's impacting our ability to hire and retain employees.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comments are similar to Senator Sedman's. Just wondering if AML is helping local municipalities and sort of the guidance on, you know, when we have developers come in and that want to do, you know, work on some of these projects, the NIMBYs are actually the assembly folks or the city council or their local government folks that are more impeding the development of properties. For example, you know, we have sort of the detached fourplex situation in the valley. You know, we have a lot of folks who just don't want those because they find them unsightly, but that's one way you can get affordable housing. So I'm just wondering if AML is helping local municipalities on breaking away from sort of traditional models and looking at ways that they can help the housing situations. And similar for the state, you know, we like to subdivide a 20-acre parcel, and then you get people who want to bring in a home residential, and then you get people who just want to have a sub-dwelling type of situation instead of just selling the piece as a 20-lot, you know, as 20-acre to a larger developer who can develop the whole thing, bring utilities and the roads into the area. So just wondering if AML is working on local municipalities on that type of education.
Yeah, through the chair to Senator Wilson and somewhat in response to Senator Sedman as well. Yes, I think that's what we're hoping to have come through this housing task force is the ability for local governments to better share between with one another what they're doing that's working and finding out what's not working. We've paid particular attention to short-term rental issues. And some of our software partners, for instance, we've got heat maps for multiple jurisdictions that show where those, you know, what those look like, what compliance might look like. But most, I think where we're at with short-term rentals is really early in a process where most local governments don't have codes developed to respond to and provide guidance to, you know, short-term rental activities within their jurisdiction. So we're supporting and are providing a consultant to communities to work through what's going on nationally and ways that we can you know, help everybody understand that. I think we've had a working group in the past that's looked at the question of subdivisions and utilities and access, mostly in relation to state requirements versus local and how those two need to come together a little bit better. I still think that's probably some work that we need to do. There was a period of time when the state changed how it approached requiring or allowing local governments to institute things like requiring utilities and access within a subdivision. What ends up happening is that the value of those properties go down, diminish over time, and you get a very unstructured, chaotic situation that ends up all of those residences coming back to their local government trying to fix the mess that that occurs. So there's a balance to be struck, but I think the cost of utilities and access certainly remains something that we all have to figure out what to do with at the state and local level and how to do those things together.
Thank you. Please continue.
There are the Housing Task Force identified a few things that the state could be thinking about, and I'll speak further to land conveyances later. In terms of access and utilities, maybe there needs to be a different approach and available funds to support local governments making those investments or offsetting the costs of developers in improving those properties. Most other states have a state special committee on housing, and that might be something we could commend to this body. Are there other types of credits that could be offered? And then really coming back to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and ensuring that they've got all available tools at their disposal to be able to help address these housing shortages and affordability. So those are things that we've identified so far through the Housing Task Force, and and so as you have further conversations, we're happy to participate in how we arrived at that and what we think could be better. In terms of land conveyances, this remains an issue. I know there's been a bill over the last 4 years, I think, a governor's bill to get Alaska lands into Alaskans' hands. And our response often to that is first get it into the hands of local governments, have an incentive to do economic development. There are, just from this list, these are some of the larger communities with entitlement lands, lands identified in statute by formula for them. There's still a pretty significant gap in those entitled lands and what has been approved. And the difference between patented and approved is one of ownership. So a community, a local government can begin planning, can work to identify, the potential for that land, or what can occur within those lands, but they can't subdivide, they can't sell, they can't develop lands that haven't been where they don't have ownership. So this remains an issue. And the bigger issue, or one of the reasons, one of the barriers, has been survey costs and the requirement for surveys. And maybe there's something there we could do.
Can you help me on this chart? Are these acres? Or
those are acres,
or people,
yeah.
What are we looking at here?
I think I'm pretty sure those are acres. And I could come back with more information on what's in here.
And then on your last comment about survey costs, it seems like sometimes the surveys are redundant. For instance, in dealing with community of Petersburg, they got a land entitlement from the state. The perimeters were surveyed by the Forest Service, and they're having to go survey them again. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. So some of this, I think, is self-induced, and maybe going through this process will identify some things we can move forward with and try to help clear up. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Andreasen, I look at these and in many cases, the patented are approved somewhat pretty closely to their municipal land entitlement. In some others, they do not. Has everyone selected and we have just a backlog and even getting to the approved stage, or are there some municipalities still working on? I mean, certainly Petersburg Borough just became a borough, right? But in other cases, is there a delay in a selection?
Senator Keel, through the chair, and in response, Senator Sedman. It doesn't all fit on the slide, so I can follow up and send you a full chart with the additional columns that would help it add up. But I think yes, there's still some issues with selection. There's additional layers of approval within this process that aren't demonstrated here. So I was trying to get just quickly to, here's a total and here's what's been approved and is available for development. And I think, Senator Stubbin, to your point in terms of almost all of these fans have been surveyed originally, I think it's required of local governments that they additionally survey them prior to approval. So it is duplicative. Maybe there are other ways to do it. Surveys are incredibly expensive and are adding to the barrier to these lands being developed.
Right. It just seems to be kind of interesting. If the survey was good enough to transfer the lands to the state, it should be good enough to transfer the lands to the community. You would think. Thank you.
Please continue.
Mentioned the impact of housing and childcare to workforce recruitment and retention. This slide pulls together a couple different data sets, one from the Bureau of Land Statistics in the upper left-hand corner that looks at the reduction in Alaska of public sector workers since 2012. Separately, this is just my math, so I imagine retirement benefits could do a better job, but I pulled out PERS active overtime from FY11 to today for PERS DB, DC, and TERS defined benefit and contribution. And I think what we found is, you know, roughly 2,000 fewer public sector employees within the system and reduced over that period. And I think there doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing about a reduction in a public sector workforce, as long as we keep in mind that it also impacts things like PERS and our pension system. That's 2,000 people fewer and a smaller payroll generally than we're paying into PERS than we were. So I think those things are important. ICER did a study a few years back, and this is the chart on the right, that said generally Alaska kept pace, public sector versus private sector, that in most cases, for most types of employees, the public sector's benefits outweighed or matched up with the private sector's ability to compensate, except for two areas. And this is where, when I look at the number of vacancies that local governments are experiencing, which on average is 15%, is as much as 50% in some communities. It's for management positions and it's for professional services. The two areas where we don't compete as a state in the public sector for both compensation and benefits.
Senator Stedman, could you maybe, if you could give us a little more information on that? That's one of the things we're struggling with is retention. Employees throughout the state and the schools for that matter, and competing with private enterprise. So if you have a little more information on that, that would be helpful, because it'd be nice to, if we're going to come up with a policy change or an incentive or what have you, to try to rectify the problem, we actually target the problem. We don't try to fix something that doesn't need to be fixed.
Chair, I'll follow up with the committee with more information.
Thank you.
Maybe this gets to some of it, at least on the pension system side. And I imagine we could talk for a long time about some of these considerations, but I will just share with you how we're thinking about the system and, you know, what I'm thinking specifically about PERS and the options in front of the state. I do, the way we've talked about it is that any changes or action should address the system, the employer, and the employee needs. And it's those three that we should be thinking about. When it comes to the system, and this is probably more from an employer perspective, the 2008 floor is something that, you know, we would want to see adjusted if that were moved forward, and maybe there's a rolling average. We know our actuaries are looking at kind of a four-year time horizon and playing catch-up. But right now, or just 2 years ago, that 2008 floor was costing non-state employers more than $1.5 million. The year before that, $2.5 million. And it seems like the system should be responsive enough to a rolling average that it could accommodate that, reduce that employer burden. When it comes to termination studies, I know we've talked about this for a long time, but at this point, I think termination studies make much more sense for everybody, for all employers, and could be tracked by employee, especially when we're looking at some of the vacancy rates experienced by state agencies, 20 to 25%. We really need to be thinking about how those vacancy rates impact projections. This AML members passed a resolution this last year that encouraged the legislature to consider the 22%, yes, a cap, but not a floor. And I think, and this is my math, and you can improve upon it, but I think for every $10 million, the state could buy down that 22% by 1% for non-state employers. And that's based on the chart at the bottom, where the ARM board had a choice to put $60 million into the health plan. 2.5% would have been added to the overall actuarial rate. It recommended 0%. If you take out the state's 64% of payroll, you leave the ability. It's roughly for that $30 million difference. You could buy down 3% and make it 19% for non-state employers, and you have that ability today to do that you didn't 2 years ago, because the state has its own rate at this point after the passage, I think, of SB 55 in the last legislature. Yes, that means an additional state contribution, but it comes on the savings that the ARM board recommended to you of $30 million. We remain concerned about the ability of employers to hire retirees without carrying that accrued liability. There are other challenges, perhaps, that need to be addressed for retirees that I'm not as conversant in, but that could be looked at to help address the workforce recruitment retention, at least the workforce issue generally. We've advocated for many years that there needs to be an exit strategy for small or stressed employers. It's worth knowing that of the total number of employers, 77 make up 1% of the overall annual payroll. And these are generally the ones that have asked for termination studies, are delinquent in payments, have arrearages, are otherwise struggling to stay in a system they can't afford. And they can't afford to get out. And I think there's not a good way for them to exit the system right now. Three other quick points. Perhaps there could be a five-year audit of employer net pension liability. It's true that when an employer loses an employee that's an entire class, they conduct that termination study. And a lot of those are carrying that net pension liability forward. It's not a lot. I think in an average year, it's $4 million. But for a lot of those employers, it's still a significant chunk of their payroll. That would require an additional state contribution or an increase there. There's a high rate, interest rate on past due payments. This year's it's 11, and prior years it's been 15. We suggest that could be adjusted. And finally, beyond a termination study, there's no current ability for employers to pay down and exit the system. Because of the cost sharing involved, that might be something that folks would be interested in. I know that the original date for PERS was 2030. The net pension liability had maybe wanted to be paid down by. That was extended to 2039. Just for one jurisdiction, I know that shift of 9 years cost them $25 million extra, even while it reduced the state's obligation by $300 million. It's no longer at 2039. It's on a rolling basis. So as long as there's a net pension liability, there will be additional contributions borne by all employers. I know that's a lot. I know this isn't a PERS discussion, but I wanted to flag for you just the way that we're thinking about system issues as it relates to pensions.
Senator Stedman, there's a lot of issues here on this slide, but on the positive side, We have talked a little bit here at the table on the 22% cap. And for those watching at home, that is the maximum the municipalities and the non-state folks would pay for the unfunded liability. And it's covered across their payroll. And we're getting close enough where we can see we're coming down to that 22%. And if we could move our liability down, the unfunded liability down some more, we could get below that 22 and do what you're talking about here, bring it down to 20 or 18 or 16. That would be an immediate relief to all the municipal participants, all the communities. And like you'd mentioned, some of them are pretty small. It's a pretty big deal. It's just going to take us a little bit of work in a few years to get there, but it'd be nice to have us set up a goal to try to attain it over the next 2-3 years or what have you, so we can deal with that. But the other broader concern from the state's perspective, without the termination studies and those costs, you'd see a mass exodus. Or maybe not a mass exodus. Anybody that could get out would get out and leave the liability behind, thereby putting the state in a position where we'd have to pick up all the unfunded liability for those participants that closed out, those communities that closed out. And that's why the termination study was put in, to stop the migration of the local liability to the state. So it's a two-edged sword, and we got to work through that. And for those watching at home, we've had conversations here with the retirement folks, and we're going to be making these payments for the defined benefit plan through this century, the way it looks, long after I'm gone and everybody in the table here. So it's a long-term payment plan.
There's a lot on this slide, as you said, so this isn't the DB hearing, but it's a good overview, because I'll save my comments when that comes back to the table on this. Thank you. Please continue.
Again, not a DB hearing, but I will just say that on defined benefit, AML members end up divided on the question, expressing some concern about any additional net pension, any risk that leads to increased net pension liability, and certainly want to think about that liability exposure. Ways that we've been thinking about it is that if it were specific to an employee group, then there should at least be an opt-in at the employer level, since employers are taking on that liability, and then for employers that it applies to. The ability to ring fence that liability, if it were specific to an employee group, would be important. And there's a couple reasons to do that. But if it were just for public safety, there are certainly PERS employers who don't have any role in public safety who would bear that liability potential. And same for other types of groups. So I just wanted to flag that. And then I know that this. At this table, you've had a conversation about how defined benefit has measured up against defined contribution, and I won't speak to that. But I did. It made me think to look at the salary survey that we do every year. 67 of 165 municipal employers respond to that. I would just note that of those, 64 are PERS employers. 42 also have Social Security or CBS or SBS or participate in those programs. And have an additional deferred comp, 35 have an additional deferred comp program. So I just wanted to mention that there are other tools that municipalities are looking at and have included in their benefits packages.
Senator Stedman, and I have a question.
There's some groups around the state that are in the state pension system, the defined contribution system. But they're not in Social Security, and they're not in SBS, the Supplemental Benefit System, which was put in in place of Social Security. In my personal opinion, that leaves those employees at a substantial disadvantage. There's a component part of the retirement system planning that's not offered to them. And that, again, that is not at the state level. That's at the municipal level. And TERS is a little different, teachers, employees. But I think that's an unfair position to put the employees in. And when AML has conversations with the local governments, I think that question should be asked, why are you not in one or the other?
Senator Sedman, through the chair, what I could offer is, maybe first let's get our hands on the scale of that issue. So we can, instead of just a poll or a broader survey, we can check in with each community and a member and see what they do offer, what they do participate in, and we can get a better sense of that and get back to you.
Thank you. I don't have a question now. You got my question. Please continue.
All right, so shifting from done with retirement, we'll shift to fiscal policy post COVID. I mean, these remain issues for local governments. The mandatory exemptions that are in place, required by law to be reimbursed by the state, hasn't been since 1987, I think. The scale of that exemption continues to increase. I looked at Petersburg numbers just recently, doubled the number of participants in that program, costing them an estimated tax collection of about $500,000. The exemption impacts different communities differently, and that's what the chart on the right shows, that for each of those communities, and I can provide higher resolution graphs, but total exemptions in blue in terms of total dollar value for each of those, the highest of those, Anchorage, and then a ratio to revenues is the moving orange line. So for some of those, even though they're small dollar value, the impact of that exemption on their overall budget could be significant. So that remains an issue, even as we're looking for new optional tools that local governments can implement in response to housing. I do appreciate AARP's national policy that speaks to how exemptions of this sort could be structured to benefit those homeowners. Secondly, one of the things that's emerged over the last few years has been an increased number of workers' comp presumptions implemented by the state, which have been good things in support of public sector employees, and especially for public safety. And I think the way what we've said in response to those presumptions is that since premiums weren't collected for those employees prior to that presumption being in place, they end up there's not enough assets to potentially address the claims that have come. So even for the presumptions that are in place at this point, since 2011, we know of at least $4.6 million in claims on very limited asset bases. And what we would advocate for is that if the state has put in place a set of workers' comp presumptions, and it believes those things are important, then it should also put in place a presumption trust, which would support the employees impacted by that presumption. And I think that's a relatively straightforward pool from which to draw from for those employers.
Please continue.
More broadly, community assistance. We continue to see the erosion of the purchasing power of community assistance. I know that's gone through multiple iterations over time. That's meant the reduction of, in the last three decades, from $90 million going out to communities to $60 million going out to communities to $30 million going out to communities. If you inflation adjust that, it's something like 984% difference between today and 30 years ago. I will say that when community assistance went away for a number of years, we saw communities close their doors. We saw sales tax rates increase and pretty extreme challenges. Part of the issue that we see with community assistance today, one, that it's not recapitalized in the currently proposed budget, and we would advocate for recapitalization. But it's also true that the fund doesn't accrue a return on investments. It's capped at $90 million. If there's $90 million there, the state doesn't allow for that to accrue any return. And that doesn't change then the output, that $30 million or the third that gets distributed to communities. It's also, I would argue, a good mechanism for you to consider if there's other funds that you want to distribute to communities, find a formula. It's a good way in which to support local governments. If community assistance isn't recapitalized this year, and if something weren't done next year, that would leave $60 million next year, and a third of that in FY25 to go out of $20 million, reduction overall of $10 million. And it hits, it's important to know that that hits some communities differently than others. And it especially hits those communities with higher per capita. And while you could assume that many of those could bear that, it's actually a pretty significant hit to their revenue for some of them. And they turn to having to draw from savings, otherwise cutting programs, staff, et cetera, or struggling to make ends meet.
Senator Stedman, I think you'll find the Finance Committee has been pretty supportive of community assistance. And we fought very hard for that over the years. So I would imagine that discussion will come back to the table and see what the committee members have to say. But I'd be surprised if they don't support community assistance.
This chart should have a watermark that says thank you. And if I should have thought about that ahead of time. But I appreciate that, Senator, and to the chair. I think the fact that this committee and others have gone out of their way to make sure that communities are held whole during this very challenging last few years is really appreciated.
Please continue.
Right, on education, just a handful of issues that I would flag. And we do have a resolution supporting an increase to the BSA, knowing that our schools are hurting. That resolution mentions inflation. It's interesting to look at the required local contribution because the required local contribution is inflation-proof. As property values increase, the required local contribution increases, and local governments today are making up 4% more of total public education funding than they were just a few years ago, even while the states has been flat. There's been a discussion about a statewide required local contribution. There's been discussion about if the state identifies a certain number as basic need, then that reflects the state's constitutional obligation in its entirety. But more specifically, I think school districts and local governments challenged by the lack of access to the school bond debt reimbursement program. And what we see is more competition within the school construction and major maintenance program. More often we see urban districts submitting projects there. We'll see greater rural, urban, or municipal REAA conflict there. One thing that we could do is maybe think about a base allocation being identified to better address major maintenance issues. Finally, there are small tweaks to public education that would help local governments, and there are at least a couple districts where the fact that they're declining population numbers has meant that they could reduce the number of schools within the district. There's a hold harmless for a couple of years, but there's interest in shifting some of those things without a penalty that comes in after those few years. So I know that's a little bit more challenging to work out, but that's something that local governments identified as important to them.
Just for one person at this table just talking about major maintenance, BSA increase, and a major maintenance, deferred maintenance construction list, notwithstanding the capital list for new schools. I support more funding for the BSA, either inside the formula, outside the formula. I don't care how we get there this year, but when you've got school districts in my districts coming in and are only able to fund the maintenance workers for 5 hours a day, how's that going to help your major maintenance get further deferred and a further, and a bigger list? You know, how can we look at taking off the school bond debt moratorium when we've got to be able to take care of the assets we got, and we're not able to do that inside the BSA? So that's my two cents. Senator Stedman, on that topic.
Well, I'd like to remind the presenter that this table has been a staunch supporter of school bond debt reimbursement, even when the administration vetoes it repeatedly, and we kept bringing it back, trying to honor the obligation that the state made to help with the school bond debt reimbursement. And also, Mr. Chairman, dealing with major maintenance, we funded substantially the major maintenance list even last year, which got peeled back, I think, $70
million. $70
million. So we were attempting to keep up with the deferred maintenance in our schools, recognizing that we've got a problem that's or a challenge that's snowballing on us. We haven't got to that point yet to have those discussions, what the committee wants to do, because it's a capital budget issue there. But that, you know, that'll come in the next couple months. But I'll be surprised if the committee doesn't about face. We've been adamant supporters of school bond debt reimbursement and maintaining our schools.
Another watermark on this slide.
Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Hey, Mr. Chair, just wondering, what's AML's number for the BSA? It looks like it's right here. It's a little bit higher than 600, which is a little different than five other numbers we've heard.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, AML doesn't have a number. This is just demonstrating how the required local contribution has grown over time. I will. One of the ways I've been thinking about it is if 15% of school district budgets are going to maintenance and operations, 15% of the BSA is $894. And when I think about the deferred maintenance and the maintenance issues, I'm looking for solutions that help address those.
Would, if I could, Mr. Chair?
Follow up?
Would AML be more supportive of, let's just come up with a group to help just rewrite the formula so we can get rid of some of the issues that you brought up, like the reducing of schools without penalty, some of the other multipliers? Some would say that the education formula is a little bit more complicated than our oil tax system.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, AML doesn't have a position at this point. I don't have a resolution to back me up on an answer to that. But I do agree it's complicated. We've certainly had those discussions that if you're going to look at the system, you want to look at the system. And I think a lot of, these are all symptomatic of a formula and a system that needs to be better addressed.
Thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To that question about, the perceived penalty for closing schools, the formula roughly funds each school based on what it costs. The flip side of that is that if you close a school, you roughly lose what it costs you. So it's not a colossal savings. How do you fund schools at roughly what they cost, but make it a big windfall to close a school? It seems like you have a mathematical difficulty there.
Senator Keel, through the chair, I was hoping I didn't get asked that question. But I can come back to you with an answer for districts who it applies to, who have flagged it for us. I do know that for those that I've talked to, they're looking at repurposing those schools for other purposes, and maybe there's still a public benefit to that. But I will work on the math.
just as a comment to that point, there have been schools in rural districts that have closed, and then 10 years later, people are moving back home and they've reopened those schools. So that's another factor to take into consideration as you're talking about this. Please continue.
For transportation, we've been doing a lot of work on infrastructure recently, and specifically transportation. I would just flag for you that, yes, we're focused on federal infrastructure funding. There remains things that to be worked out between local governments and the state on transportation. And, you know, we can look at efficiencies and more effective systems for deploying funds to meet transportation needs. That includes, you know, looking at leveraging local assets to reduce budget estimates. We want to avoid, I think, at the local level, state requirements that add ownership or maintenance when funding is available, and that those should be negotiated processes that look for savings to all parties. The state indirect rates on public transit pass-through dollars remains an issue that many of our communities are challenged by. Communities doing transportation projects have seen the need for higher contingency, which has increased budgets overall. Not a bad thing to have that contingency, but has increased the need for more available cash. I don't know that the Municipal Harbor Facility matching grants are in the current proposed budget, but we definitely want to see those in there. This is a great partnership between the state, local governments contributing 50% and matching the state's dollars to see harbor improvements. And finally, we've been doing a lot of work on planning at the regional level, and where we only have just 2.5 metropolitan planning organizations, there's the potential for regional transportation planning organizations. It appears that that would require a change in statute to allow for RTPOs. And there's an RTPO light that we and DOT is pursuing. I think it's been presented to you, regional planning organizations. But this would be a step up. So something to know is out there.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you. Has AML considered looking at, since most of your communities are reliant on one port in one municipality, have you looked at looking at creating a port authority to better disperse and better manage that asset of the state of Alaska?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, we've talked about best practices as it relates to port authorities. We've also talked with the Maritime Administration about there needing to be an Alaska port strategy, and I'd love to see something like that developed where we can have a more cohesive understanding of how ports interrelate, intersect, and how we see development occurring in the future.
Thanks.
Please continue.
I think I'm almost done, I promise. Energy, another big issue for a lot of communities. I want to thank the legislature for continuing to look at ways to improve or reduce the costs of energy experienced by many communities. Including recent changes last year to PCE that increased the investment into those communities. But you know, one of the things, so it's easy, we've got a resolution in support of increasing funding to the Renewable Energy Fund to make funds available for community-level projects. I think for PCE, what we want to make sure there is, we want to make sure there's no disincentive to a community investing in a project that might have an impact in reducing its costs below the PCE level, and specifically for communities that bond for a renewable or other type of project, once they fall below that PCE threshold, there's nothing in place to help reimburse them for that bond debt that they've added on. So there's something there that I think we could look at additional incentives. Increasing prices on the supply chain, fuel costs, inflation have meant that for communities that have relied on the bulk fuel loan program managed by the state, there's a current cap of $750,000 that the same purchase that they had a couple of years prior, now they need $1 million for And so that cap is problematic, and we want to make sure that they have access to that cash to manage their fuel costs over time. And we want to make sure that the rates that the state's charging are low. And I don't think it's appropriate to pay for things at the state level out of communities who can ill afford it in the first place. Finally, we're looking at grid resilience is a term that the Department of Energy is using for improving community level systems. So a lot of competitive and formula grants coming to the state that communities need to be aware of and we're supporting.
And this is something that we're working on in the Senate as well. So I'm glad to see the governor put that working group together and to come back to the to a conclusion in short order, I believe the end of May or 1st of June. So more to come on energy. Next.
Overall about how to strengthen local governments, this slide reflects some of those communities who it could be considered rural, disadvantaged, they're smaller communities. This is the state's operations and maintenance best practices dashboard. You might otherwise know it as RUBA. And I only bring this up because I look at the dashboard. I want to see improvement overall in our communities in being able to address best practices and see scores improve. I don't know when I look at this dashboard that I see the improvement that we all hope for. The fact that we haven't made a real difference in best practices scores in the last decade is concerning to me. And it's not that communities are failing in their testing. It might be that we're failing communities. And I want to explore ways that AML, the state, communities can be better partners to improve conditions of governance and fiduciary responsibilities that are undertaken. I know these test scores are directly related to water and wastewater improvements and funding provided by the state, but I think they speak broadly to communities that are struggling. And they were struggling before the pandemic. They were struggling during the public health emergency and the economic crisis. And they are struggling post-recovery to make sure they've got the capacity necessary to implement responsible, responsive governance and financial activities. So this is a priority for us to work to improve this the condition of communities and their ability to meet the standards set by the state.
Senator Wilson?
With over $2 billion coming to the state to address this issue, this may not be the best metrics to continue to use as those IDRA funds get dispersed. Because you may have one huge area and sort of just your preventative efforts and but maybe not in compliance, maybe not in payroll or just overall operator. So just a little grain of salt.
Yeah.
I'd just like to add, you know, this slide's a reflection of what these 193 communities. But as somebody that spent most of the summer traveling up and down the river system, I'm fortunate to represent some communities that's had wastewater and water treatment plants pre-oil built in their villages that are as good as the day they put them in there. That's the pride that they take in those. So, and then sometimes we set them up for failure in other villages and overbuild a system that they didn't even ask for. So, thank you.
I'll close with, in terms of AML being a partner in this, I think there's lots of opportunity for us to build on the things that we've done. I mentioned early in the presentation the work we're doing on the Alaska Remote Seller Sales Tax Commission. We're collecting sales tax for 5 communities right now, just within their communities, so that they can increase compliance. We're implemented a number of programs that we think help to address those disadvantaged, those who are most disadvantaged. Part of that is through collaboration with state agencies. We have that memorandum of agreement in place with Alaska DOT to work on transportation issues and to support local government engagement at that level. That's a model for all state agencies where AML can be a conduit to strengthening local governments in relation to DEC, DCRA, you know, pick an agent, DNR. We can help facilitate good collaboration. We want to see communities that are successful in revenue collection and compliance, and we'll look at ways to improve those things for those communities so that they've got the capacity to pick up all the other issues that I've described in previous slides. We're looking at new ways to identify project needs, including, you know, call for projects for heavy equipment or public safety capital needs. If we can bundle those projects together instead of request to the state for a loader or a fire truck or pick a thing, maybe it's, 30 of those that make more sense so that we can get communities what they need and lift some of the burden from them describing those needs to you and to others. We are definitely providing grant writing and technical assistance, not just in response to IIJA or the infrastructure, federal infrastructure law, but we'll expand that in years to come so that communities compete not with each other, but with the nation and with counterparts around the nation for funding to come in. We want to look at shared procurement of services and ways to support them in project management. Grant management, quality improvements as they're deploying federal investment dollars. And then we do offer health insurance. We offer retirement services, investment services, unemployment insurance, leadership development, liquidity analysis, and supporting their federal compliance. AML is a different kind of partner than it was 5 years ago, but in a lot of good ways. And I think it can support the state in its own activities and to meet the needs of communities. Thank you.
Any final closing comments from committee members? Thank you. And thanks for what you're doing to, and your group doing to connect communities to not leave any grant dollars on the table. And we appreciate it. So that will conclude today's meeting. Tomorrow's agenda, 9 a.m. The committee will hear from the Department of Health on the SNAP backlog, Medicaid eligibility redeterminations. We are adjourned at 10:17.